disappointed.
The Committee of Higher Education and Workforce Development will now be in order. Today's date is Thursday, February 12th. So today we welcome the students from the University of Minnesota. They are having their day on the Hill. So students, if you're in here, I don't know if they were focused on coming to committee. Sometimes they are, sometimes they're not. If there are any U of M students in the room, please stand up to be recognized. Okay, well, maybe some will dribble in later, but no problem. We don't mind. Okay, so we are really excited today because we're going to have a chance to hear the Governor's Blue Ribbon Commission on the University of Minnesota Medical School. And I know we've all read about it. We've heard a great deal about it. The governor has indicated strong support in his higher ed proposal. And I think you'll see that the Senate, too, strongly supports that report. So with that, I would ask Commissioner Pogemiller and Dr. Jackson to come to the table. And members, there's a lot on the agenda today. Following this, we'll be doing kind of a mental health summit day and also have the opportunity to hear Senator Claussen's bill associated with that. So in whatever order you'd like, Commissioner.
Madam Chair, thank you. I think it'd be best if I just mention what the commission did.
Great.
And then I think turn it over to Dr. Jackson, who I think is who you really would like to hear from. So members might recall back about August 1st, the governor created a Blue Ribbon Committee on the University of Minnesota Medical School. And on page 10 of the report is the group of members who are on that. It's a pretty diverse, other than myself, a pretty august group.
And
very significant people in terms of running healthcare systems and world-class researchers. It's a really pretty significant group that met for the governor. Governor laid out four things that he was hoping the group would provide some advice on. First was kind of ensure the medical or bring back the medical school to national prominence with regards to research, and that is typically ranked by National Institute of Health research rankings. Secondly, to help the university or sustain the university's leadership in care innovation and healthcare delivery. There are some things that the university is doing that are cutting edge with regards to healthcare delivery. Thirdly, expand the clinical services of the university so that it maintains and is a good statewide resource for providers and patients all over the state. That's kind of a land grant piece of this. And then finally, address workforce needs in the healthcare area around the state. So those were the four things that the governor asked that we discuss. We met six times. And the committee basically recommended pretty unanimously, kind of seven strategies that should be considered that are laid out in the report. And the governor's recommendation is a subset of those strategies. And I think the whole thing needs to be viewed as a multi-year investment if you're trying to deal with all of these pieces to the medical school's activities related to Minnesota. So the seven strategies are basically around build a culture of excellence and increase faculty productivity at the university. Have a vibrant academic clinical enterprise. Short version of that, make sure the University Medical School and the Fairview Health System have a productive partnership, I think is the way to think about that.
And excuse me one second, Commissioner. Members, you have a one-page sheet that's different than your whole booklet that does list out these. It's titled Governor's Blue Ribbon Committee on the University of Minnesota Medical School.
And I'm at the bottom, strategies. That's what I'm doing right now. Creating something called medical discovery teams, or which would, in essence, restore the university back to the level of tenured research faculty that it had in the good old days, or 20 years ago. And we're basically down, the university's down about 100 faculty members, and Dr. Jackson can go further into that. There's also a piece about capital infrastructure here that obviously would not probably be addressed this session, but perhaps next session, with regards to both educational facilities at the medical school and clinical facilities at the university. Invest in innovative, groundbreaking healthcare workforce needs programs. That relates to like the Duluth Medical School program, and RPAP, Rural Physicians
Associate Program.
Associates Program. And then there's an urban version of that, MetroPAP. And there's a disagreement, although some will come today, and I don't want to undercut. Let's say there's not total unanimity on what is the shortage and what isn't the shortage of healthcare workers, but there's absolute agreement that in certain parts of the state, we don't have the doctors and nurses and specialists that we need. So whether there's a total shortage or not is kind of a debate, but that there are shortages exist in crucial parts of the state is absolutely agreed to by everybody. And then the last thing then is making sure that we keep developing new models for healthcare promotion, overall healthcare promotion delivery. So the governor then, as you heard last time I was here, has chosen the medical discovery team piece of this recommendation and the lack of healthcare professionals in rural and urban areas as the two pieces he thinks he's suggesting we invest in now this year. It doesn't cover all the items in the overall report, but it's a start, and it's a multi-year proposal. And the governor's suggesting $30 million for this coming biennium, and $50 million for the next two or three bienniums. And that should be viewed as kind of, and Dr. Jackson will get into this, that is, based on the report, that is about half the resources that are needed to get the university back to the top quartile of NIH funding, which would be the top 10 or 13 in this country. We are now rated 30th. And this will probably get us into the top 20. I think the hope would be is if this kind of investment is successful, people will be coming here a few years from now saying, let's keep it up and get into the top 10. And the chart on that sheet shows you kind of the pattern of research faculty at the university. When it went down, our rating in NIH funding went down. So there appears to be a pretty strong correlation between whether you have the researchers to do the work and whether they're able to bring in the scarce resources of NIH funding. And I want to make sure I mentioned the first time I was here, the NIH funding measurement is not the end-all and be-all. It does not measure everything. But it is the commonly accepted ranking nationally as to where your university is in terms of medical research. So it has its limitations, but it's important.
Great.
I would stand for questions or turn it over to Dr. Jackson.
Any questions at this time, or we'll hear from Dr. Jackson. Good.
Madam Chair, thank you very much. My name is Brooks Jackson. I'm the dean of the medical school, as well as Vice President for Health Sciences. And in the near future, one of the interim CEOs for the Fairview Healthcare Systems as well, and chair of the board of the Minnesota Health component of that as well. So I do want to very much thank you for this opportunity. I'd like to just make a couple opening remarks that having a strong medical school is vital to the health and well-being of Minnesotans, and having strong support from the state is vital to the work that we do, training the next generation of health professionals, providing excellent patient care, and conducting research that will lead to new treatments and cures and preventing disease in the first place. The plan that was put forth by Governor Dayton will have a direct benefit on the citizens of the state, ultimately, in that Minnesotans will have longer, healthier lives, I think, with this proposal. The recommendations will provide a foundation that we can build on to fulfill the mission of the state, to the state, and to truly become a world-class medical school. So first, hiring up to 50 new tenure-track members will allow us to create what we're calling medical discovery teams, which address some of the most complex health issues of our time. So to be a little bit more specific, the idea is that we're putting together right now a committee of external experts and some internal as well to decide what those five or six medical discovery teams are. This will mean that we will pick an area, whether that's diabetes, whether it's finding the cure for pancreatic cancer, it could be healthcare disparities, addressing that, which is a very important issue and has explained some of the biggest gap in life expectancy that we have in the state of Minnesota. It could be development of new vaccines, whether it's for Ebola or new strains of influenza. But the idea is that we'll build on, we will decide based on taking into account the strengths that we have as a medical school in terms of research already, our patient populations, what NIH funding is available in these areas, as well as working with our industry partners in Minnesota. I think many people probably realize that we have some 650 healthcare companies in Minnesota, 400 medical device companies, so there's lots of opportunities to partner with these companies as well in these areas. And we think that to leveraging what we have, that we can really become world-class in these specific areas. And we want to be able to differentiate ourselves from other medical schools and really be considered the top in these areas. As Commissioner Pogamiller mentioned, you know, we're ranked 30th now out of 144, which is, puts us about the 20th percentile. We think that this investment will get us in 5 years from 30th to 20th. And think we can get up in the top 10, maybe in another 5 years after that. I do want to point out, though, that the medical school, there are other types of rankings, and we are ranked sixth in the nation in primary care and fourth in rural medicine. I mean, we really are top in a number of areas and lead in terms
of a state.
Excuse me,
Dr. Jackson, fourth in what? I didn't get
it. Rural medicine.
Rural medicine.
We, as a state, have one of the, we've been either first or second in life expectancy and in terms of affordable care as being one of the lowest cost. So Minnesota is in great shape, and I think the medical school has been doing an excellent job in training physicians for the state, and obviously we can see the results of a lot of those that training, as well as I think probably a lot of the better lifestyles of Minnesotans in general, I'm sure contribute to that as well. But research, as Commissioner Pogamiller said, you know, the university had medical school, health system had some major financial problems in the mid-90s, and this partly resulted in a number of faculty leaving, and it's been an uphill battle to get back up there. And this proposal will really allow us to recruit then top faculty who are already NIH funded, and then we can, this money will be used to help build on that so that these teams of 8 to 10, 11 top faculty for these teams will work on a specific problem. And so that, we think, is the best strategy to leverage what we have to become a top research medical school as well. In addition, we think that as part of this proposal, there was also some funds in here for the Rural Physician Associate Program. Just explain what that is. Since 1971, we've had this program that's been funded by the state that gives medical students a $9,000 stipend, which is applied against their tuition if they spend 9 months in a rural area of Minnesota. We find that half of those students will stay after in practice in those areas, so it's been very effective in doing that, but we're finding it's tougher. The $9,000 stipend has been the same for the past 44 years, so part of this money would be to increase that as well as increase the number of students that we could provide there. As said, we're not sure we have a total physician shortage, but there certainly seems to be a maldistribution geographically of physicians as well as in certain in specialties. So we do train some of the most primary care family medicine physicians in the United States. But you know, Minnesota is a very large state, and there are a lot of rural areas that where there's not access to a number of health professionals. And so part of this money will be used to supplement that, as well as a Duluth Rural Scholars program. So that is what is in the governor's proposal, to be more specific. So we think that will strengthen the rural healthcare in the state and increased access to our underserved communities in those areas as well. So at this point, I'll be glad to take questions. That is, in essence, the proposal. Not everything in the recommendations, as Commissioner Pogemiller pointed out, is in that proposal. There is this other part we called Healthy Minnesota, which is part of the university's request, and that is still on the table, and I'll be glad to come back and talk about that at a later time as well. But this is the...
Madam Chair, I just want to make one other point that is it crucial here. There's an expectation, I think, by Dr. Jackson, the university, and by the governor, that this kind of investment by the taxpayers would be in some manner matched by private fundraising. And there's no specific numbers attached right now, but I think we can't pull this off unless there's a upping of that game with regards to this type of research at the university.
And Madam Chair, if I could just point out one other thing that I forgot to mention. When other medical schools have had a really strong, vibrant research a component of their medical school, there's been tremendous spinoffs to the community in terms of economic development, in terms of healthcare-related industries, new companies that are formed, and jobs. It does tend to attract then the best students, the best faculty. So I do think the return on investment here is not just to the medical school, but I think to the state in a number of areas, specifically in economic development and jobs, as well as new treatments and cures, of course, for patients.
Right. So. Members, questions? I have questions, but I'm going to make sure. So you mentioned that as you bring in these researchers that you were going to put them into, essentially, it sounds like practice groups around particular areas of research. Are those identified, or does it depend on who you recruit? Is there something that you have in mind?
Well, that's what I was mentioning about the committee, where we're bringing in really some of the top researchers in the United States, as well as some of our top internal people, to decide what those we want to do this very carefully and thoughtfully so that the money really is well spent and invested. So as I mentioned, you know, it's likely some of these areas will be some area of cancer, some area of cardiac disease, neurological disease. Neurological disease, just to give you some idea, I mean, 20% of Medicare dollars are now spent on Alzheimer's, for example. I mean, there are some major health areas that I am sure that we will be involved in that respect. As well as it could be in things like healthcare disparities, which... You know, for Minnesota, while I mentioned we have some of the best life expectancy, there are still major gaps. Some of the biggest gaps are in this state, especially with our new immigrant population, for example. You know, if you go down to the Phillips neighborhood, down on Franklin Avenue in Minneapolis, the life expectancy is 13 years less than if you go a few miles over to the lakes, in Lake Calhoun, Harriet, for example. So this is being able to narrow that gap could really make a difference for life expectancy, because I think ultimately what we want to do is everybody have longer, healthier lives. I think that's the ultimate goal here. So.
And is there some interest with regard to the president's initiative that he announced?
Yes.
That we know the Mayo already is working in that arena. Do you foresee the university moving in that direction?
You know, I personally do. I think that is a very exciting area to be able to Treating disease is one thing, and certainly does provide some extra years. But if one can identify through genomics or proteomics which individuals are susceptible to certain diseases early in their life, and knowing how to either decrease exposure to different things or to be able to use potentially different drugs to prevent cancer to begin with, for example, or neurological diseases to begin with, this would be clearly is a much better return on investment if you can prevent people from getting sick in the first place and be allowing them to live a healthy life at least until their 80s or so. That would be very, I think, a major step forward. And that's what that initiative is partly about, as well as people who are sick, identifying targets that specific drugs could act on without all the side effects that one gets often with some drugs.
One of the comments I've made to you, Dr. Jackson, that I just, if you would comment to the committee, is with regard to patient-centered care and having that really be our top priority. And I know you came from Johns Hopkins, who has, a very fine reputation of both being a leading research institution, but also delivering, the highest standard of patient care. So can you just say something about, was that part of the discussion in the overall commission, and is that something that you think that we'll see a difference?
So I think that is one area. We tend to call that patient outcomes research, which does involve quality and safety and making sure that we optimize the current therapy we have as opposed to, developing new discoveries or cures. But that is a research area that is very important because the IOM reports have said, there are a lot of issues with regard to access and coordination to care and sometimes safety. So that clearly could be an area. It is a very important area. There's no doubt about it. I think, our healthcare system, we've made it a major priority that we do have better access, better coordination of care, better, more affordable care, and that one can feel safe and secure when one is treated at these health systems. So, yes.
Madam Chair, along those lines, in the report, you will see that the capital educational facility aspect is to basically bring the educational facilities at the university up to where modern medicine is practiced in that manner, so that they're looking for teams of healthcare workers to be educated together on how they will practice when they get out in the real world. And so they need to take a, I don't know how old that building is.
Mayo building?
The Mayo building is pretty old. And I guess the way we would think about it, it's pretty siloed. And what they want, what they're ultimately going to come forward with, I don't know if it'll be for the next bonding session or not, but they will come forward with a request to turn that educational facility into a more team-centered approach to medicine, which is kind of where healthcare is headed.
Right. Good. Any other questions? Senator Torres-Ray.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Dr. Jackson, I am interested. I'm looking forward to read this report, but as I hear you presenting, I can't help but to think about some of the major corporations who struggle to provide enough incentives to bring people to Minnesota and to make sure that they stay, that they have enough incentives built into the packages that they offer. So I'm curious to hear your perspective. I mean, if we are number 30,
right.
And then we have this weather, and then we have problems recruiting. What are some of the two, three things that you think we should really start thinking about very seriously and pretty fast here in terms of helping you? Because it is a challenge if we are number 30 in the nation, and then we have all of these limitations. Getting enough incentives for faculty to be up here, for students to come up here, is just not an easy task. So I'm wondering if you can give us, I'm going to read more, of course, the report is all about that, but I'm just curious as to if you were to pick a few that
3-4 that you think we should be thinking about it very seriously?
Well, first of all, we only recruit faculty in the summer. Second, I think what's exciting for these faculty are these, you know, the idea that these resources, which are substantial here, for a medical discovery team to be part of that and have access to those resources, as well as being able to work with other top faculty, is what really drives a faculty person. I mean, I was a researcher at Hopkins for almost 20 years. And that's what's exciting about the place, is the ability to work with top people on an important problem. And I think that's what really is going to be able to get us to recruit them here. I mean, Minnesota does have some real positive things about it, other than the cold weather is a negative to a lot of people, not all people, but to a lot of people. But it is a beautiful campus, and the Twin Cities are there's lots to do here. I do think that a lot of jobs here for spouses and things like that. So, we do not have that difficult a problem recruiting faculty in general. It is true. If they have some connection here, it is a lot easier. But once they're here, they don't leave, and that tends to be the case. So I think we'll be able to do that. Just based on this medical discovery team, that's what these people really enjoy and like, being part of that team and having resources to be able to make a difference.
Lastly, if you look on page 14, where it shows how the NIH funding has really gone down over the years, we just wondered, let's say we do bring these researchers here, do you have confidence that that they're going to be able, in a shrinking pool, to be able to get that kind of investment back in terms of getting those awards?
Yeah, so the graph shows that the chance of getting funded has dropped from 32% to about 18%. So it is more difficult. There's no doubt about it. However, more of this NIH funding is being allocated to team-based research, which is what we're proposing here, as opposed to individual investigator-initiated grants. So I think this will make us much more competitive for this funding. Clearly, we are going to also focus on areas in which the largest NIH institutes are involved, because they have the large amounts of funding. Now, whether NIH funding could go up, I mean, right now I saw the president's budget was for $1 billion increase, or a 3.3% increase, which would certainly be helpful. But I think, as I said, the strategy, you want to focus on something that society views as extremely important, and if you are successful, it will have great impact. I think doing this is team-based science, which is where the NIH is moving a lot of its larger grants, is the way to go. So I think this is why we picked this strategy.
Very good. And then I thought that I heard President Kaler, so I'm glad you said it so that I could get this clarified. I thought President Kaler was backing away a little bit from the Healthy Communities request if, in fact, the governor's recommendation was fulfilled in that some of that would be, duplicated in that effort. Is that not the case?
Madam Chair, I have not heard the President Kaler say that, but the Healthy Minnesota request was submitted in the fall, was also part of the committee's recommendation. So in that sense, there was a component in the Healthy Minnesota request that had some research dollars in that, and that is, it hasn't been voted on yet by the regions, but that is coming out, because that, so that part of it would be taken out of Healthy
Minnesota. Do you have any, recall how much that was?
I believe it was $8 million.
Thank you. That's very helpful.
Madam Chair.
Commissioner.
I just wanted to, and I should maybe ask, I don't mean to embarrass Dr. Jackson, but what's going on here is that the university, President Kaler and the university, have attracted one of the world leading researchers in the country to our campus. Now, his spouse is has a relationship in Minnesota, so that helped. But Dr. Jackson was like the top NIH refunder research person bringing money in at Johns Hopkins. And Johns Hopkins is kind of the gold standard in the country for this activity. And so he knows, you know, we're betting here a little bit that he does understand how this works. And I think the commitment the university has made to him, and if we can make a similar commitment from the taxpayers, I think, and when you talk to health professionals around Minnesota who have all kinds of takes on all this, particularly when you talk to people who think the highest priority should be workforce, you know, forget that research thing, just do workforce. After saying that, they then say, but Brooks Jackson can maybe pull this off here in Minnesota. So I think that's what we're dealing with, an opportunity, which, you know, there's no guarantee, but there's an opportunity that the stars have aligned here a little bit, and the university's committed to it. And if we can get the legislature and the governor committed, I think maybe we could look back in 5 or 8 years and say, hey, not bad.
Well, Dr. Jackson, we welcome you to Minnesota. We're thrilled you're here, and thank you for reporting today. Oh, go ahead, Dr.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Just one quick question, and my apologies if you already answered it, Dr. Jackson. At one time, I know there was I know it's a very universal number, but it was a number of, regarding NIH dollars. And for, like, every $1 million of NIH funding that an institution receives, it equals so many jobs or so much economic impact on the state. Is there that type of metric now? It was about 10 years ago when I actually heard that, and I'd like an update.
There is a metric on that, but I don't recall what that return is. But there is a metric, and we can get that for the committee.
Thank you very much. Yeah.
Thank you. Senator Eakin.
Madam Chair, Dr. Brooks, I was wondering, as far as the research is concerned, if there's a breakdown as far as how much is being spent on prevention and cures and how much on treatments, if there's any kind of a breakdown and any reasoning behind it.
At this point, no, I could not tell you how much is treatment, how much is prevention. Although I will say, you know, certainly there is much more interest in prevention these days. I'm sure that will be a major component of it, but not all of it. And in fact, if it's a given, I mean, I'll just use an example of pancreatic cancer, which is one of the most devastating progressive cancers there is. I suspect if that were one, that there would be a focus on treatment. But of course, in figuring out how to treat such a disease, you learn a lot about the whole critical pathway in developing cancer, which provides a lot of opportunities to how to prevent it. It's usually not just one or the other, especially when you put together a big team like this who will likely look at the whole spectrum of that particular disease.
Thank you.
Madam Chair.
Commissioner.
Senator Nelson reminded me of something I wanted to make sure I mentioned. Part of the governor's thinking. You and the governor, the previous legislature and the governor made a significant investment in Rochester. If you put in the Mayo Clinic, if you put NIH research at Mayo and at the university together, we're in the top 10 right now. So this kind of investment at the University of Minnesota potentially puts the state in a really top position if we pull this off.
Great.
When you consider that Mayo is part of our state also.
Thank you very much, and thanks for being with the committee today.
Thank you.
All right, so now we move to our mental health summit part of our agenda, and we'll begin with the overview of the presentation, Gearing Up for Action, Mental Health Workforce Plan for Minnesota.
Thank you, Madam Chair, members of the committee. I'm Sue Averholden, Executive Director of NAMI Minnesota, National Alliance on Mental Illness. And you were all very gracious back in 2013 to actually pass a bill that directed MNSCU to do three things. They had to develop this comprehensive plan, one, to increase the number of people working at all levels in our mental health system, two, to ensure that people are obtaining the proper and appropriate coursework and training, and three, to create a more culturally diverse workforce. As you might remember, the reason for the legislation is that 9 out of 11 regions of the state are designated as mental health workforce shortage areas, and it's not just psychiatrists, but it's really all mental health professionals. I have served on a lot of task forces over the last 30-some years and read a lot of reports. And I just have to say I really have to thank Ms. DeFore and Ms. Rosenthal. This was one of the best working groups that I have ever been on. It really captured everyone's ideas. You know, they went around the state. I know they're going to go through the process. You know, we did surveys. We had a leadership group that met. We had a wonderful workforce summit where people came and gave ideas, both people who live with mental illnesses, their families, and professionals and others. And what we have is actually a report that is something that we can that can really guide our work in the next couple of years. You know, often you do these kind of big things and you have these recommendations that you think, oh, well, that's nice, you know, and will anything ever happen with it? This has very concrete things, some that require legislation, others that we can continue to work on kind of in the interim, but they are measurable, and I think they really will move us forward so that we have enough people working in our field so that when you give the mental health system more money, we can actually hire people to carry out that work. And I know you're going to give us more money this session. But again, it's just it is a wonderful report, and I would really urge you to take the time to quickly read through it. And the mental health community couldn't be happier with working with MNSCU. We didn't know how this would go because we had never partnered before, but it was a truly an excellent experience.
Thank you very much.
Right. Madam Chair, members of the committee, thank you, Sue. I'm Valerie DeFore. I'm the Executive Director of Health Force Minnesota, which is one of eight centers of excellence within the Minnesota State College and University system. So back in 2013, MNSCU was legislatively mandated to assess the mental health workforce in Minnesota. And you can see the exact language on the one-pager that I think you just received. I'll try over here. And so as the Center of Excellence within MNSCU that works on healthcare, Health Force Minnesota was really tapped to lead this work. And so for the last 19 months, I have to say myself and my colleagues at Health Force have really been, I think, just honored and really humbled to do this work on behalf of the state of Minnesota. Health Force is located at Winona State University, and we have a 10-year history of partnerships and collaboration all across the state. And we really used that kind of paradigm and that strength to lead this important work. So the documents that you have received and the report itself is it's not a MNSCU document. It's not a Winona State document or a Health Force document. It really is something that was intentionally developed to serve all of Minnesota. So to facilitate this work, we convened a 37-member steering committee. And I suspect anyone who's done this kind of work before would sort of say that was crazy. But we really did that very intentionally because we wanted to have all kinds of expertise and opinions and people represented and working with us as we went down this path. The representatives on our steering committee, you can see the members on page 2 of the kind of the fold-up nicely printed plan. So that'll give you a sense of the breadth and depth of those who worked with us on this mental health workforce development plan. The committee includes representatives from higher education and not just MNSCU. We had the University of Minnesota as well as the private colleges represented in the steering committee. We had state agencies including DHS and MDH. We had healthcare employers, mental health associations, and many others. We made sure that the committee represented rural Minnesota as well as the metro. We made sure that we had a variety of cultures and ethnicities involved in the steering committee. At the very first meeting of the steering committee in November of 2013, I kind of looked around the room and I said, I think we need to meet every month. And I think it speaks to the importance of this work and the commitment of those involved in the mental health field that everyone said yes. The steering committee really did make this work possible. I'd like to thank them, and I'd also really like to thank Senator Clausen, who served on our steering committee sponsored the original legislation that caused this work to happen, and we just couldn't have done it without his participation. To further inform our understanding of the mental health workforce, we held forums in 14 communities across Minnesota, and we also presented and listened and heard from people at 6 other large conferences or meetings. We really wanted to reach the breadth of the state and to hear input and insights from all corners. All told, over 400 people met with us to talk about the mental health workforce within their regions. We also sent out an electronic survey asking for input into the mental health workforce development plan. This was not an academic survey. It was one that was really designed for our steering committee to send to their constituents, so that we could get, again, that input that we wanted. Over 500 people responded to that electronic survey. 20% of those were families with family members who have mental illnesses. 40% of the respondents were from Greater Minnesota. So we really were pleased with that approach. Just to give you a sense of what we were hearing, through those forums and the surveys, we heard things like, after hospitalization, his first psychiatric appointment was 3 months later because of book schedules and too few psychiatrists in our area. We heard, we need more mental health professionals who speak more than one language and who are more culturally competent. And we heard we could probably double the number of case managers and still not have enough. So we are really hearing from employers and families and people who are really impacted by workforce shortages throughout our state. On May 28th, 2014, we held the Mental Health Summit at Hennepin Technical College. And the summit was a full day. It was kind of a roll up your sleeves and get to work event. We had 150 people attend the summit. 30% of those were from Greater Minnesota. And over 140 recommendations were generated through that the summit and the small group discussions of that day. So throughout the summer and the fall of 2014, the steering committee worked to really synthesize all of this input and to identify recommendations to put forward in the mental health workforce development plan. We ended up with 24 recommendations. And I think it's really important to note that all of the recommendations, all of those 24, were consensus-based. So our steering committee very intentionally said, there is enough to do in the mental health workforce development realm that we can all agree upon. They were not interested in recommendations that were contentious or divisive. They really wanted this plan to be actionable and achieve some outcomes. So they were all consensus-based recommendations. The recommendations are grouped into 5 categories. There were 3 related to recruitment, 15 are related to education and training, 2 to high needs areas, 3 are related to retention, and 1 is related to assessment. 14 of the 24 recommendations require or would benefit from legislative action or funding. And those, we actually summarized our summary onto this one-page document that lists the recommendations just specific to legislative action needs. These recommendations range from very specific. So you'll see recommendation number 1. It's expand scrubs camps to reach all regions of the state and include mental health career exploration at each camp. Some are very broad, such as recommendation 23, which is increase reimbursement rates. The final recommendation is recommendation 24, and that calls for Health Force Minnesota to evaluate the progress made on these recommendations in July of 2017. This was really important to the steering committee that we take that step to include that recommendation so that we can monitor what's been done. What is have we implemented recommendations and have we acted on them? So related to that goal of having action and impact, almost every one of the 24 recommendations has a champion, has action steps, and has funding needs identified. And all of that detail is available in your larger 40-page document. So, for example, you might look at Recommendation 23. It says increase reimbursement rates. But when you go to your larger, more complete document, you'll see that there are five specific actions related to that recommendation. I think you wanted to highlight some.
I want to make sure members do get enough time because it is a lot to digest. Yes. I can't believe you did 24. That's a lot of recommendations.
Oh, I think we had in total probably 500 to consider. So we were very happy with 24.
Okay. And Ms. DeForest, I want to thank you for your work on the pipeline project. And,
yes, thank
and
you.
How, really, with your leadership, we did identify two positions that respond to the mental health needs.
It was a nice
blend.
Connection, yes.
Yes, thank you.
Thank you.
And Madam Chair, I just wanted to add that people were very creative in this. So, for example, you often hear about the guilds, they all have their little walls around them. And one of the things we realize is that there aren't enough places for people to have their supervisory experience. So the guilds are actually coming together to figure out, could a licensed clinical social worker actually supervise someone who wants to be a professional clinical counselor? And so they're really looking at how can we break down those barriers, which, frankly, you don't really hear very often. And another one is just an easy one. We want to make sure that young people, especially from diverse communities, hear about these as professions. And so one idea was for the school-linked mental health grants, because they're already in all of the schools, especially city and things like that, well, they have to hold a career day as, part of their grant. So it was, very creative ideas came out of this.
Outstanding.
Yep.
Ms. Rowe, go ahead.
Oh, sorry. So I'm just going to wrap up. We're very proud of this work. We wanted to make sure that it was easily disseminatable, could easily be disseminated across the state. And so with that goal in mind, let me just share. We do have on our HealthForce Minnesota website a four-page executive summary of which is mostly recommendations. We have the 40-page plan, which has more of the process and some background and the detail behind the recommendations. And then we also have a 266-page document that includes appendices. And the appendices, the majority of them are related to what we heard as we went across the state. So it's respondents to the survey and the community forums. Some of you have the full deal, but we do have the report available in three formats, and we're happy to assist in getting copies out as needed for you.
Outstanding work. And does Ms. Rosenthal have any?
I think Senator Claussen has a bill that he wants to take.
Okay, good. Senator Claussen.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I was the token layperson on the group, and it was a very educational experience for me in many ways, working with professionals in the mental health field. And I'll never forget, I think more than once I was asked, as Ms. Abbott Holden said, I think when people serve on these committees for many times in the past, they kind of wonder where this is ever going to go. And so I tried to assure people that that was going to be my job in the legislature. And so you're going to be hearing from me here in just a few minutes on one of the proposals that came out of the work of this group. So these ladies just did a fantastic job, as you can see by the report and the effort and commitment they made to the report. And I really greatly appreciate your work. Thank you.
Thank you, Senator.
Madam Chair?
Ms. Rosenthal.
So I was the person who went around to all of the different communities that we held these at and tried to elicit workforce recommendations and really trying to get people to focus on workforce and what it can do to help deliver mental health care was really interesting, and trying to get people to go from 30,000 feet down to about 3 feet and think about what could be done rather than just complaining. And one of the things that I heard from Wilmer to Grand Rapids to the White Earth Indian Reservation is that particularly in Greater Minnesota, people and their families are in a world of hurt. There is no net out for them. And if you are a family member whose child is struggling with a mental illness and you are up around, say, in Bemidji or Thief River Falls, you do not have a lot of reserves to fall back on. And they were very, very generous about coming and talking about this, but they expect some implementation of some of these recommendations. And I just really want to underscore that. They are tired of talking. They really want something to be done. And thank you very much for giving us this assignment.
Well, thank you very much. We greatly appreciate your work. Excellent. And you can trust that Senator Claussen will make sure that there's action this year at the legislature.
Excellent. So.
Good. All right. Our next report. Oh, and the students did come in. Students, we did acknowledge you, and you weren't here, so stand up, U of M students, and be acknowledged. You make a difference. Thanks for being here. And while Senator Claussen's on his way, perhaps Senator Miller would like to introduce his university president who's here.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I'd just like to introduce Dr. Scott Olson. We're happy to have him here. The president of Winona State University is in attendance today.
Very good. Senator Claussen. And Senator Claussen, we'll have you take us through this report, and then we're going to go to your bill, so just make sure you give yourself enough time for your bill.
Right. Yeah, it's right there. That one, yeah. And then if you want to just keep it there.
This game?
Sure.
Madam Chair and committee members, thank you for the opportunity to provide an overview for the Legislative Healthcare Workforce Commission. And we have a slide presentation. I think you also have some handouts that you can be using as well. So with that,
Mr. Schoenbaum, perhaps you could sit on the other side of Senator Claussen so that people can see the text behind him on the screen, those who can see it. Thank you.
I'd like to begin by just sharing a statement from Dr. Aaron Ferrier, who is the director of the North Carolina Health Professionals Data System. It points to the complexity of the healthcare workforce issues and decisions that we're faced with, and also points out the importance of state legislation in solving these problems. Licensure, scope of practice, state loan repayment programs, ensuring a quality and sufficient healthcare workforce are but a few of the healthcare state level responsibilities that we as legislators must address. The commission was formed as a result of legislation passed during the 2014 legislative session, in which authorized a two-year study with four main charge statements. The first was to identify healthcare workforce shortages in our state. Secondly, to study how to develop and retain a highly skilled healthcare workforce, including a review of incentives currently available to attract and retain that workforce. Thirdly, to study alternative incentives to develop, attract, and retain a highly skilled and diverse workforce. And lastly, to identify barriers related to the primary care workforce, including training and disparities in income between primary care and other providers, and then why are medical students and other health care professionals moving away from primary care professions. During the 2015 legislative session, we will be introducing legislation to address these charge statements, including Senate File 3 that you'll be hearing shortly. And I'd like to remind the committee that the commission will continue working on the charge statements during the upcoming interim in preparation for the 2016 session. The next slide identifies the 2014 members of the commission and also the House members that have been selected to serve in 2015. And their input was greatly appreciated as a working committee during the summer and fall of 2014. The commission held 6 5-hour meetings. Meeting objectives, topics, and focus were aligned to one or more of the charge statements, as you can see in this chart. Dozens of stakeholders provided testimony related to the identified topics, in addition to prepared materials that we use to educate commission members. And at this time, I'd like my commission colleague, Mark Schoenbaum, Director of Rural Health and Primary Care for the Minnesota Department of Health, to review the planning process and provide an overview of the state health care workforce, workforce shortages, and emerging health professions.
Thank you, Senator Claussen. Madam Chair and members, I'm Mark Schoenbaum from the Health Department. Among our responsibilities there is to be the place in state government that looks at the health care workforce with as much of a focus as we can bring to it. We were very pleased that the legislation creating the Legislative Commission on the Healthcare Workforce assigned MDH to provide staff support to the commission, which we were happy to do. It was a great opportunity, great project, great to work with Senator Claussen and the other members of the commission. Just continuing to work through some of these slides here, as all of you know and you've heard today, the commission work took place last year amongst an interesting variety of other healthcare workforce projects, including the pipeline project that you were responsible for, Madam Chair. The commission, turning to the next slide, called planning framework. The commission approached its work by trying to look at the big picture, using what is perhaps an overly simple construct, but to look at the healthcare workforce of the state, to try and understand what the needs were, to try and get a handle on how many healthcare workers would we have, and then to see did we have a surplus or a gap. And as it turns out, in many fields, there is a gap. And some of the detailed ingredients of that simple framework can be found on the slide below the diagram. Another way the commission approached its work was to try and ask and answer the question, what are the steps that it takes? What are the points along the way that it takes to end up with the workforce that we need, where we need it, with the skills and qualifications that the population needs? And here's another opportunity to use the pipeline term, which I'm sure is not the first time it's appeared before this committee. And it begins at the K-12 level by preparing kids in math and science, attracting them and recruiting them into health careers, providing them the education that they need, and giving them exposure to the settings where we will need them the most. And once they graduate, they will have all kinds of choices and offers, so we need to attract them to those places where they are needed most. We know, and you've discussed already today, that we are not going to be able as a state just to train ourselves out, to produce ourselves out of the workforce shortages that we face. So the changes in the healthcare system play a role in that. And then once we have people in place, we need to do our best to help them stay there and make their careers. A lot of the discussion today already and on the bill that will be before you touches different parts of that workforce development pipeline. Just some facts and figures I will try and get through quickly here. There are over 400,000 employees in the healthcare sector in Minnesota, 14% of the jobs in the state, and that sector is projected to have a much higher growth rate than employment in the state as a whole. Turning the page, you can see the largest healthcare occupations in Minnesota by both number of employees and percent of healthcare employees. The commission had members from both, I think by design, had members from both the Health and Human Services divisions and policy committees and the higher education divisions and policy committees. So in addition to looking at the employer side things. The commission also looked at health professions education and heard extensively from the university, from Minsku, from the private colleges, and from the proprietary colleges in the state. You have a top-level summary of health professions students in a recent year from the database subscribed to by the Office of Higher Education. Almost 26,000 students a year receive health professions credentials of some sort. Turning the page, there's already also been some discussion of, do we have a physician shortage and how big might it be? The commission looked at that and didn't answer with a single answer, but took note that there are a range of projections out there, almost all of them projecting a shortage of physicians in some degree, and noted that advanced practice nurses and physician assistants are also in high demand. The next slide with the professional shortage areas, health professional shortage areas, is I know too small to see, but in addition to looking at the raw numbers, the commission did look at the distribution of health professionals around the state and took note that distribution is not even, and depending where one looks when looking at primary care, mental health, dental occupations, there are shortages in all or some of Minnesota officially declared by the federal government. And finally, the commission took note of some significant developments in Minnesota, some of which originated in this committee to add to the traditional healthcare workforce by what are called emerging health professions, and you can see the list of them here. Minnesota appears to be ahead of most other states in tapping this new kind of research.
And to sum things up, there are a number of recommendations that the commission made to the 2015 legislature. They're identified there, creating a governance council to provide an ongoing assessment of healthcare workforce trends, training issues, financial policies, and to make recommendations to state government agencies was one of the top items. Also, addressing preceptor needs, another item. Supporting STEM programs that expose students to health careers at an early age, supporting proven loan forgiveness programs, consider recommendations from other study groups, some of which you've heard today, the Mental Health Workforce Summit, also the Pipeline Project, the Governor's University Medical School Blue Ribbon Committee that's been presented today, and then also to look at developing a more diverse workforce, and lastly, support telehealth expansion in emerging healthcare professions. For 2015, again, we will be meeting once our legislative session is ending. The commission will study scope of practice expansion for healthcare professionals and continue to study healthcare workforce supply and demand needs. That concludes our report, Madam Chair.
Thank you very much, Mr. Schoenbaum, Senator Claussen. I would assume that this also gets reviewed with Senator Sharon's committee, and will and other folks will be reviewing it. We appreciate the look at it here because of the intersection of higher education, as you mentioned, and the workforce elements. So we really appreciate you taking us through it, and we will get back to you with our comments. Thank you. Any other brief comments before we move on? Because we have Senator Claussen's bill to do as well. Senator Sharon.
Well, thank you. I really appreciate this hard work. I know this is really important. And I really am committed in our Health and Human Services Committee to having the conversation about what you've discovered here. What I'd like to do in the committee, Senator Claussen, and members of this committee, in our Health Policy Committee, is have these kind of contextual discussions about an issue that precede legislation coming for the committee, so that the committee has some basis on which to say what is the priority here. For example, we've already had hearings. One of my bills was the expedited license for physicians, which deals with a recommendation that you do have here related to reducing any barriers to telehealth expansion. And so a number of initiatives that come through our committee along with this. Another initiative that that I'll be bringing forward is assisting foreign-born healthcare professionals to find their way to be able to practice in our state. So there's a very strong tie between what you've described here and what the educational needs and the development of the workforce through education, but also the kinds of work that we will be doing that remove barriers or expand access to these professionals into the healthcare system. So I really appreciate the work, and I look forward to having it come in front of our committee.
Thank you, Senator Sharon. And that is why we asked to have these all of this done today, so that now as we hear bills, we do have some context for looking at why they're coming forward. So I agree with you. Okay, so with that, we have Senate file number 3 before us. Senator Klassen.
Very good, Madam Chair. Thank you. We do have an amendment. Would you like to hear that now? Or
let's have it before us, sure.
Okay, very good. It is the 3A amendment.
It's in your packets, members. It's the A3.
Madam Chair, I'll just briefly explain major amendment provisions. On page 1, line 1.4, it clarifies designated rural area as a city or township outside the 7-county metropolitan area, with the exclusion of the cities of Duluth, Mankato, Moorhead, Rochester, and St. Cloud. The reason this was put in, that previously it had a population stipulation, and that would have eliminated approximately 11 to 12 various communities around Minnesota that really could benefit from the bill. And so we've changed that and looked at more major cities in the state of Minnesota. On line 34, page 2, there are some clarifying statements adding mental health professionals to the loan forgiveness program. On page 3, line 16, mental health professions is deleted in reference to the addition that was made on page 2, line 34. And section 4, Minnesota Statute 2014, section 144.1501, subdivision 4, is amended to include a statement to give preference to loan applicants who document diverse cultural competencies. And lastly, on page 4, lines 7 and 9, include the appropriation request of $3,131,000. And that is the scope of the amendments, Madam Chair.
So, members, we're in policy right now, so we aren't going to be addressing the financial aspect of the bill at all. And so, Senator Klassen, this is the first stop, and he would like the bill to be before us. And it's not the first stop.
Second.
Apologize. Okay, so we do have this amendment before us. So let's vote on the amendment and then look at the bill as a whole. So all those in, who would like to move the amendment? Senator Sharon moves the A3 amendment. All those in favor say aye.
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 Opposed? Motion is adopted.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And again, good afternoon, Madam Chair, committee members, and thank you for the opportunity to present Senate File 3, which is a health care loan forgiveness proposal. Has been talked about here today, and some of the statistics you've seen, healthcare is the fastest growing industry in Minnesota. It's actually outpacing the national average when you look at other states. However, we also know that our state is not keeping pace with the industry workforce needs. And this is especially true in rural and underserved communities. To address this concern, Senate File 3 provides targeted loan forgiveness to healthcare professionals who agree to practice in rural and underserved communities. This initiative is a result of two legislative actions. In 2014, as you've learned, the two-year health care commission to identify current and anticipated health care workforce shortages. We just presented that information to you. The recommendations that you have seen are contained in this bill, as you'll find. Also, 2013, we just had a report on the mental health workforce needs. Over 30 mental health professionals worked on that, as you've heard, and their recommendations are also contained in the bill. Not all, but some, again.
pertaining to workforce loan forgiveness. Among the recommendations that you will find, both study groups supported the expansion of existing health professional loan forgiveness programs to meet the needs of rural Minnesota and underserved communities. This expansion includes an increased funding allocation and additional funding of mental health professionals, public health nurses, and dental therapists to the state loan forgiveness program. And this time I'd like to call upon Mark Schoenbaum. He will identify the healthcare workforce shortages in our state and outline the Minnesota loan forgiveness program.
Thank you very much.
Thank you, Madam Chair. You've already had, members, kind of a quick look at smaller maps. The point has already been made. I probably won't linger too long on these maps. Unless there are questions, I think the maps do point out is that there are parallel federally designated shortages of mental health professionals, dental professionals, and primary care professionals in both greater Minnesota and inner cities in Minneapolis and St. Paul. Moving on to the next narrative slide, and I would also direct your attention to a handout you should have in your packets on the loan forgiveness program. The front page of the handout describes the program a little bit, talks about its budget history, and if you turn it over down the left-hand column, you will see the occupations that currently are eligible to apply for a loan forgiveness incentive and the conditions that they must work in qualify. You can see that there, several of the occupations, the requirement is to work in a rural community. For nurses, the requirement is to work in a nursing home. For dentists, it's to see high numbers of Medicaid patients. And perhaps of interest to this committee, those who are preparing to be faculty members of health occupations are also eligible for loan forgiveness. Successful applicants must serve the particular condition for a minimum of 3 years, or they have to repay the money with interest, and they're eligible to remain for a fourth year. If you look at both the slide, which points to outside objective program evaluations on the loan forgiveness program, and the more recent update on your handout, see that in addition to recruiting, being a recruiting tool to attract new graduates to where they are needed most, the program has a good track record as a retention stimulus. And many people, most of the participants who come through the program, stay in the same or a similar setting for many years and often make their career. So it appears to have that long-term effect as well.
Thank you very much. One last question. Is this proposal in the governor's budget?
It is not, Madam Chair.
Thank you. Okay.
Just a summary of the three provisions of the bill. First off, it increases funding for the Minnesota Loan Forgiveness Program. We've talked about that. Secondly, it targets that loan forgiveness to rural and underserved communities, providing an additional 200 healthcare providers over 4 years to needy communities. And lastly, it adds mental health professionals, public health nurses, and dental therapists to the loan forgiveness program. The next slide shows a number of professions on the left. It provides some examples of the Minnesota loan forgiveness program, the effect on student debt for selected professions. The chart includes the three professions. Senate File 3 proposes to add to the loan forgiveness program the public health nurses, the mental health professionals, and the dental therapists. Overall, the forgiveness amount after 4 years is around 60% of the total loan amount that the student is carrying. We put the last slide here about the Minnesota Daily There was an article in the Minnesota Daily on the loan forgiveness. They had heard about it and support it. And an interesting story on the day that we had a press conference about a month ago on this channel, one of the local news channels called and wanted to do a story on it. But the story was preempted because it was a bad weather day in Minnesota. By the time I got back to talk to the reporter doing the study, and she said, though, that they had been over to the Minnesota dentist school and also the medical school, and they just were stopping students along the way and talking about the proposal. And she said, we really gathered quite a crowd of interested students. So we know that there are people that will partake in this program. With that, we do have some testifiers. You're familiar with Sue Abderholden. She was just up a few minutes ago.
Why don't you bring a few of them up so we can
line
them up?
Dr. Kathleen Mackin, a residency director at the United Family Medicine, located on West 7th, just a few miles from the state of from the capital here.
Ms. Abderholden.
Madam Chair, members, just because there's not much time left, I just want to say we support this. It's a great idea. You've already heard why. Thank you.
Thank you, Ms. Abderholden.
Dr. Mackin. And Melissa, Dr. Melissa Zant. We could call Dr. Zant up as well.
Thank you, Senator Claussen and Madam Chairman and members of the committee. I feel really privileged to be able to have come to discuss this on this occasion and previously. I have had the opportunity and privilege to direct a residency in family medicine for 23, soon to be 24 years, in a federal qualified health center. So with care of underserved being a huge part urban, and you would say, well, how does that relate to rural? Many people train in urban settings because of the robustness and the richness of the opportunity to serve and to see many patients, and they're able to translate that into very similar circumstances in the rural setting. We're privileged to have approximately a third, maybe a little bit more of our residents choose to do rural family medicine and bring tremendous skills and needs to the community. I was particularly struck with the discussion of mental health needs, and I know our physicians as family docs both find those needs to be extremely prevalent in rural and also to need to work with an integrated team. And I would say, now I'm a grad from a very long time ago, that people are really learning to train in an integrated team way, both urban and rural, and it's very critical to the health of all of the communities to really be able to be successful and serve the needs of the community. When you make a decision to be a primary care doc, in this day and age, contrasted with when I went to medical school, you really are making a huge decision to serve. It's a tremendous commitment fiscally for you and your family, and the average debt Dr. Zant can speak to is sizable, and you have to be very thoughtful in your decision in terms of how you live your life, both balanced and with this great privilege and responsibility of being a doc. I do know for sure that primary care docs work really, really hard, like many other people in the workforce as well, and to have less burden and to be able to have a balanced, satisfying, very, doable life so that there isn't total burnout from this, big burden of debt, I think is really fairly critical in sustaining people in the rural setting. And I think that all the data has really supported that. So,
well, Dr. Mackin, thank you so much for being here.
Sure.
And, your residency program is actually something that our committee supports. We don't support many things where things are singled out in the higher ed bill, but but your residency program is one of them, so we really appreciate the work that you're doing.
Well, thank you, Madam Chairman. We're very grateful for that. We feel lucky to do the work, and we know there's plenty of it, and we are, I just think you will find that people who choose this and all of these opportunities to serve in areas of need have major commitment to the health and wellness of those communities. So
thank
we're lucky.
You.
Madam Chair and committee members, thank you for letting me speak today. My name is Melissa Zant. I'm a second-year resident at United Family Medicine, and I'm originally from Rochester. I earned my medical school degree from the University of Minnesota Duluth, and that's where I first learned about rural family medicine and learned how interested I was in that as a career choice. I also had the opportunity to participate in the Rural Physicians Associate Program you guys heard about earlier in today's session, and that really solidified my choice to go into rural family practice. I decided to attend United Family Medicine as my residency choice because they do a great job of preparing us for rural full-spectrum primary care, and I had the opportunity to work with some recent graduates from our program on my RPAP site who were just great, stellar physicians who were ready to take on the challenges that come with being a rural physician. I will be completing my program with a significant amount of debt, close to $200,000 of student loans, and the opportunity to apply for any additional loan forgiveness would certainly be helpful. I hope you will support the Senate File 3, and I thank you so much for your consideration.
Thank you. We have heavy hearts when we hear those debt numbers because we're so grateful that you're willing to serve, particularly in the rural program. And so it's no accident that it's Senate File 3. It's in one of the top, you know, six bills that the Senate has put forward because it is such an important priority for us. So thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Anyone else, Senator Klassen?
No, unless there's people from the audience.
Okay, because we had two more people on the list who said they wanted to speak, Jean Anderson and Kathleen Picard.
Madam Chair, and I think
Senator Torres Ray.
Ms. Anderson's testimony is related to an amendment that I have, I believe.
Yes.
So I don't know if you want to hear her testimony now or do you
well,
want
no,
to...
Well, no, why don't you...
introduce my amendment.
Yes.
I think Senator Clausen is aware of this amendment for dental hygienists. I believe that that conversation took place during in the Health and Human Services Committee. There was an oversight that the language addresses dental therapists but not hygienists. And in the report that we received, there was a clear example, the university student debt by degree, and the dental hygienist is listed as one of the degrees for whom, you know, we really need to address this issue. I think it has received a lot of support. We've made a lot of progress in this area, and so I'm bringing this as a, you know,
yes, this is clear.
Language that needs to be incorporated into the bill in order to address that specific category, Madam Chair.
Senator Klassen.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Dental hygienists were not recommended through either of our two groups. Mental health, of course, wouldn't have dealt with that. We've tried to look at two factors. One is, where are the greatest needs? I know that we have some incomplete information about the needs across the state as far as do we have shortages in areas, and dental hygienists is one of those. The second criteria that we've been looking at is loan debt, trying to address those professions that we have identified as having shortages in the state. Which of those have the greatest need for some loan reduction? And so we've used those two criteria in identifying and putting our bill together. Again, dental hygienists were not part of that simply because they did not come through our committee process, our commission process. And then secondly, we really don't have good data on do we have actually a shortage throughout the state of Minnesota.
So, Senator Claussen, are you suggesting then that you don't support the amendment? Would that be the short answer?
Madam Chair, I've actually been inundated with different groups that want to get on the bill, and I know that there have been amendments that have been accepted in the House, so they are there. I would guess that at some point, you know, that will be ironed out in a conference committee or some other. But I've quite honestly, I've tried to hold the line, so to speak, in making what we presented in the bill the only professions that we would address in Senate File 3.
Senator Sharon.
Thank you. Perhaps you could help me understand what the difference is between the advanced dental therapist and the collaborative practice dental hygienist.
I'm not exactly an expert in that area, but...
I think the person next to you,
yeah.
Senator Claussen.
Yeah, Ms. Anderson can answer that question.
You think she might know.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, I'm Jean Anderson, and I've been a dental hygienist for 43 years and an educator for 26. And I represent the Minnesota Dental Hygiene Educators Association, not the association. And I can speak to the advanced dental therapist and dental therapy quite well because I'm at the University of Minnesota, although I'm not speaking for them. But I went through the process and also lobbied for that legislation back in 2008 and 2009 very actively. Advanced dental therapist, dental therapist graduates without the advanced dental therapy scope of practice. So there are some additional scope of practice items that the advanced dental therapist can do under general supervision when a dentist is not present. Okay, so dental therapists without the advanced dental therapy certificate practices mainly most of their scope of practice with a dentist on site. So both the advanced dental therapist and the collaborative practice hygienist can engage in a collaborative agreement with a dentist to enable them to work off-site after a certain number of hours of experience, and that varies between the two. The advanced dental therapist is 2,000 hours, and the collaborative dental hygienist is 2,400 hours, which equates to approximately 2 years of experience or more, depending on the amount of hours per week they're engaged in. That's basically the answer to that. I can get more specific if you wish.
So, Senator Sharon.
I'm sorry. Go ahead.
Well, I just had a question. Do you know the average debt load of the both comparatively?
I think they have the numbers for the advanced dental therapist. The debt load isn't increased to become an advanced dental therapist. The scope of practice is included in the dental therapy program, but it's the hours of experience that leads to the certificate. For the dental hygienist to achieve a bachelor degree, there's a range between $27,000 and $75,000, depending on the institution that they graduate from. So that is comparable to several of the providers that are identified in the statute and proposed to be added to this bill.
Senator Sharon.
Thank you. I was in the legislature when we went through the process of developing the collaborative practice dental hygienist. And I remember that it was a very, very contentious kind of conflict between the hygienists who wanted to have an advanced practice concept and the dental school itself at the University of Minnesota.
I think that was for the advanced dental therapist that was the more contentious of the two. The collaborative practice dental hygienist was 2001, and I believe that was did not receive as much opposition, Senator Sharon, if I'm correct.
Is the advanced dental therapist that comes out of the hygienist advanced practice, is that included right now in this this bill, Senator Claussen?
Senator Claussen.
Yes, Madam Chair. What is identified are the dental therapists, advanced dental therapists.
I guess I'm not.
Senator Sharon.
What I'm trying to understand is that the conversation that is important to me is whether or not we're advancing a dental therapist level of practice that comes out of the School of Dentistry and disregards a similar and equivalent profession that comes out of a different educational system that in the past has been in conflict with one another. And I don't want to contribute to that by eliminating one of those groups in preference for another, that when they are coming through different educational systems, but they have essentially the same competencies and scope of practice.
Madam Chair, I know that when we discussed this, and again, I'm not an expert, but I think one of the things we did look at as a commission was the scope of practice, and we felt there was a significant difference. And the other thing that, going back to our commission report, one of the recommendations that we made was to create a governance council that would really look at the various issues that we're talking about now. In some cases, we don't have a lot of good data on some of these professions around the state as far as current needs, retirements, future needs in the workforce. And so what we hope to do is, by introducing the council, that we be able to have a better handle on some of these professions and have a better grasp on making recommendations to the legislature.
Senator Torres-Ray.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And I'm just quite surprised, Senator. My understanding was that in the report that we have before us on page 24, the actual degree that is listed is hygienist. And that's where I got surprised, because your bill, as it was amended, included the dental therapist, but there was no mention of the hygienists. And my understanding was that the House included this precisely for why that's Senator Sharon is articulating some of the issues around, you know, the two need to be there. So I understood that the committee and that you will be supportive of this, because we didn't want to put this two professions kind of in separate places, prefer one over the other, when the report itself is identifying hygienists and not therapists. So I don't want to put you in a tough place, but I think that the legislation as it is really needs to include the hygienists too. So I don't know why, you know, the Senator, I don't know why the reluctance to include this particular profession.
Madam Chair.
Senator Klassen.
Senator Torres-Ray. That chart is looking at debt, and so we did include it as just looking at the amount of debt that a student would have. But again, it was not, it was a comparison chart, nothing that would really foster a recommendation as such into the bill that we have.
Madam Chair?
Ms. Anderson.
I had several points to make, and I could make a few. And that is, the dental hygienist is really the preventive specialist in the dental team. And those essential services are really overlooked, but very blatantly important when you look at the Center for Medicare and Medicaid Services data. Even from 2013, only 36% of eligible children who are on Medicaid received preventive service. I also would like to point out that although there appears not to be a shortage of hygienists in certain areas of the state, there definitely is a shortage of services because of access to care. So where there aren't dentists, there aren't hygienists. But the collaborative practice dental hygienist has the capability of being mobile and working remotely under a collaborative agreement.
Thank you. Mr. Schoenbaum?
Madam Chair, just to, as the manager of the Loan Forgiveness Program, maybe just a couple of principles that we think of in evaluating these things. And they've both been mentioned here, but just really briefly. For loan forgiveness to be an effective tool, a profession has to have a significant enough debt that the prospect of debt relief is going to influence their behavior. And in addition, from a kind of a public policy perspective, we have to have knowledge that there is a shortage of the occupation and probably a differential shortage so that we can decide where we want to encourage indebted graduates to work.
Got it. Thank you. Senator Nelson, and then maybe we could wrap it up and take a vote on the amendment. Go ahead.
Well, I just have one quick comment, and I appreciated the testifier talking about the cost of degree or certificate, $27,000 to $75,000. And the reason I brought that up is because on page 24, the chart that the University of Minnesota is measuring is average student debt by degree. And I think there's a significant difference there. There are a lot of things that go into what the debt level is. Did you get any scholarships? How many semesters did you take? How many courses did you take towards your degree? Did you work during the summer? Did you have personal savings? And I think that's what we really should be looking at. We should not be looking at those things because there are a lot of variables that make up that debt load. But we should be looking at the cost of degree. And that's the thing that I would like to see as we look at. Well, first let me say I support the bill. I support the bill. It's an essential bill. But as we look at what other necessary occupations should be added to the bill, I think we need to really look at what is the cost of getting that degree. And so it'd be great to see a chart about not the debt load for all of these degrees, but the cost, you know, the average cost, high to low, for all these different healthcare professions that are so needed in the rural area.
And also, members, I just want to remind you that this is going to go to the Health and Human Services Committee, the Finance Committee, and so it seems to me that that's the committee that has the expertise with regard to some of the questions. So I, for one, given the conflict around the subject, would personally before letting that community with our committee with the expertise and the dollars as well be the ones to arbitrate this final decision.
We're paying for this.
So, Senator Torres-Ray, do you still want that motion before us?
I believe that Senator Clausen is also in Health and Human Services, if I am not mistaken. No.
Madam Chair, I was previously, but not this year.
Okay, I'm sorry, I forgot. Madam Chair, if you don't mind, I would like to
take a vote.
Okay. And then if it doesn't move forward, I will continue to work with Senator Scheer and others to clarify. But it was my understanding that it was precisely the report that was brought to our attention created kind of the compelling argument for incorporating this language.
Got it. So all those, so Senator Torres-Ray renews her motion to amend Senate File 3 with the A2. All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed?
No.
Motion does not prevail.
Thank you.
Senator Sheeran.
And may I just ask, because I see that the appropriation is coming from the Commissioner of Health for the purposes of Minnesota statutes, how that was thought through as to where the money should come from for the loan forgiveness program and what the history or the experience is of the health department.
Senator Sheeran, I can answer that. The current loan forgiveness program is within that budget. So this expands the current program.
Thank you.
Very good. So any other? Oh, there is one more testifier briefly. Thank you.
Good afternoon, Madam Chair, members of the committee. My name is Kathleen Picard. I'm a licensed physical therapist, and I'm the chair of the legislative committee for our association. Having grown up in a very large rural family, I know what it's like to get to the table late. So I'm here today to talk in support of adding physical therapists to this loan forgiveness program. There is no current loan forgiveness program for physical therapists either at the state or federal level, which is one reason why you don't have data on physical therapy. The data comes out of the National Health Services Corps, and we do not have the privilege of participating in that corps. In terms of a need, there is a growing demand of physical therapists, both in terms of aging adults that want to stay active and healthy, as well as just the general population becoming much more aware of the true value of our services. There is this greater demand predicted, and our association is saying by the year 2000, 20, there could be a national shortage of physical therapists by 27,000. The debt with regards to earning a doctoral degree, which is the degree that is granted to physical therapists in all five programs in the state, is $120,000. And coupled with that, the entry-level salary is only $65,000. I would also assert that placing physical therapists in this program brings rehabilitation to the program, which is not included at this point. It also brings health promotion, which is what physical therapists engage in as well. We're commonly thought about in terms of rehab, the kinds of things you see after the fact, and people rehab themselves back to healthy functioning. But we do play a very strong role in health promotion in a lot of the complex medical conditions that cost so much. When we look at the cost of obesity, the cost of diabetes, heart disease, even depression, the common denominator where we come in terms of movement, which is the fundamental building block for activity and exercise.
Thank you. We do hear your request. We do understand. Our committee is past 15 minutes past time, so if you could just wrap up your comments.
Sure. I'll just make one more quick point. It's kind of bold and audacious. I'd like you to think about the primary care gap and how difficult that is to fill, and that physical therapists can help fill that gap because a very large percentage of what comes to a primary care doctor's office in the outpatient setting are the kinds of conditions that physical therapists are trained to treat. So with that, I'll stand for questions.
Thank you very much for coming and taking the time to come to the table late. We still appreciate it. Senator Nelson.
Oh, thank you, Madam Chair. I just wanted to say, as a person who's going through therapy right now to rehab my left knee, I think physical therapy is at the top of my list. And let me just say, though, it really does prevent a lot of more expensive care.
Exactly.
So although I just want you to know that I think it's incredibly important, and it does save dollars.
Thank you very much.
Yeah, thank you. Okay, with that, excellent. Senate File 3, we need a motion. Senator Claussen, would you like to move that Senate File 3 be recommended to pass as amended and moved to finance, referred to finance?
So moved, Madam Chair.
All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Aye. Opposed? Motion is adopted. And now, with that, committee is adjourned.